It's truly a pleasure to be here in Sioux Falls. I'm especially pleased to be here because this marks my first official visit to South Dakota since I became president of the Minneapolis Fed. I think it's really the first time in probably over 35 years since I've been to South Dakota. Drove to Rapid City with my parents, and my mom had an interesting experience with the oven in our motel, but I won't go into that now. And it also means that in 2010, I visited all six states that encompass the 9th District in the Federal Reserve's 12-district system. I had the pleasure of meeting with a number of business leaders from the Sioux Falls area prior to this event, and I want to thank you all for taking the time from your busy schedules. Included in this group are current and former members of our bank's board of directors and advisory councils for small business and agriculture, and I would like especially to thank them all for their service to the Federal Reserve and by extension to the nation as a whole. As we'll discuss more in a moment, one of the great benefits of trips like this is to meet with local residents to gain a deeper understanding of what is happening in the local economy. One of the pleasures of giving a talk like this is being able to take your questions at the end, because that's what I learn a lot from. In this speech, I'm going to plan to discuss current macroeconomic conditions and the Federal Open Market Committee's recent actions taken in response to those conditions. I'll move on to dive a little deeper into conditions in U.S. labor markets. I'll close by talking briefly about uncertainty and its drag on the economic recovery. And I should say that the views I express here today are my own and not necessarily those of my colleagues in the Federal Reserve System. So let me start, though, with some basic context about how monetary policy gets made in the United States. The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis is one of 12 regional reserve banks that, along with the Board of Governors in Washington, make up the Federal Reserve System. As I mentioned, our bank represents the 9th of the 12 Federal Reserve districts, which includes Montana, the Dakotas, Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. 8 times per year, the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, meets to set the path of short-term interest rates over the next 6 to 7 weeks. At that time, all 12 presidents of the various regional reserve banks, including me, and the 7 governors of the Federal Reserve Board contribute to those deliberations. Now, actually, in the September meeting, there were only 4 governors, not 7. And the good news is, in the interim, we went back up to 6 by November. And the White House has nominated Peter Diamond for the 7th, the open slot among the Board of Governors. And Diamond just won the Nobel Prize in Economics in October. However, the committee itself consists only of the governors, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and a rotating group of 4 other presidents, currently Cleveland, St. Louis, Kansas City, and Boston. I'll be on the committee in 2011. So we've got the Federal Open Market Committee itself is the governors, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and a rotating group of 4 other presidents, and then I'll be one of those rotating, I'll rotate onto the committee myself next year. Now, in this way, the design, the structure of the FOMC mirrors the federalist structure of our country and our government. Representatives from different regions of the country, the various presidents, have input into FOMC deliberations. Now, the input from the presidents relies critically on information they receive from their districts about local economic performance. Now, we obtain this information through the work of our research staffs. We also obtain it from business leaders and industries and towns, in my case, from across the Upper Midwest. The Federal Reserve is deliberately designed so that the residents of Main Street are able to have a voice in monetary policy. So with that as a backdrop, let me discuss the FOMC's most recent actions. The foundation of the committee's discussions is what is called its dual mandate. By statute, the Federal Reserve is required to provide appropriate conditions for long-run economic performance by achieving both price stability and maximum employment. Now, the former objective of price stability is generally understood as keeping inflation in range between about 1.5% to 2.5%. The second part of the mandate, maximum employment, is more of a moving target. This employment is shaped by many determinants beyond the Fed's control: demographics, social custom, taxes, technology, and so on. Over the first three quarters of this year, PCE, personal consumption expenditure inflation, has averaged roughly 1% at an annualized rate. So as I said, the FOMC's target is roughly 2%, somewhere between 1.5% and 2.5%. So this 1% is low relative to the FOMC's targeted range. The more troubling thing is that inflation rate has been drifting downwards. Over the preceding two-year period, from the fourth quarter of 07 through the fourth quarter of 09, PCE inflation averaged 1.6% per year. So we went over from 1.6 over the 2007 to 09 period down to 1 in the first part of this year. And I'll just add, here I'm talking about total inflation, not core inflation. So sometimes it's called headline inflation as opposed to core. So I'm including food and energy in this calculation. At the same time, unemployment is high. In October, it was 9.6%. Here, too, the trend is not comforting. The recession officially ended in June of 2009. And in that month, unemployment was 9.5%. So unemployment has actually risen slightly during the course of the recovery. Now, sufficient growth in output can steadily lower unemployment. But growth has been low in this recovery. As I mentioned, the recession officially ended in June of 2009. And so the recession's been over for five quarters. Over those five quarters, real GDP has grown an annualized rate of under 3%. Again, alarmingly, growth has been decelerating. In the past two quarters, it has averaged less than 2% at an annualized rate. So this is the economic situation that confronted the FOMC at its November meeting. Inflation and employment are both too low, and the pace of recovering these variables is too slow. Economic growth is low and softening further. I think it is safe to say that given the situation, the FOMC would have liked to have been able to cut its target interest rate. But this option is not available. The FOMC's target interest rate is already essentially at zero. More precisely, it's being maintained in a range between 0 and 25 basis points. But the FOMC does have another policy instrument available, its balance sheet. At the beginning of this month, the FOMC had a portfolio of roughly $2.3 trillion. Just to give you a little context, in September 2008, that number was $800 billion. So over $2 trillion of those dollars are invested in Treasury securities, or in what are essentially government-backed securities issued by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and other government-sponsored enterprises. At its November 30 meeting, the FOMC announced that intends to buy $600 billion of long-term treasuries in the open market by mid-2011. In exchange for those purchases of securities, it will credit the seller's accounts at the Fed with more reserves. And this kind of action is known as quantitative easing, or QE for short. So what's the goal? Why is the Fed doing QE? What's the goal of this transaction? The main goal of QE is to lower the long-term run real interest rate. So just to be clear here, by real interest rate, I'm referring to the interest rate net of expected inflation. So you might see, read the newspaper, the interest rate or the yield on a 10-year bond is 2.5%. If people expect inflation to be around 2% over the next 10 years, then the real interest rate on that bond is 2.5 minus 2, or 0.5%. Over the next 10 years. Why does the Fed want, or the FOMC want, to lower the long-run real interest rate, the long-term real interest rate? That's to stimulate the economy. A low interest rate stimulates the economy in a number of ways. It spurs consumer spending by allowing consumers to borrow and refinance more cheaply. It makes capital expenditures and hiring more profitable for firms and stock prices and house prices rise because those assets become relatively more attractive as investments. Those households that own such assets as stocks and houses become wealthier, and they will demand more consumption in turn. All of these effects should lead to less unemployment and upward pressure on prices. Now, how does QE go about lowering long-term real interest rates? So this is a question that where you're going to get different answers from different economists. It's not the only question you get different answers from different economists. But QE especially is a sufficiently novel monetary policy tool that I think you would get different answers to this question. So I'll give you my view about how it works. QE lowers long-term real interest rates in two distinct ways. The first is that QE is essentially a form of nonverbal communication about the FOMC's future plans. Here's what I mean. So the November FOMC statement says that the committee will keep the Fed funds target range exceptionally low for as long as economic conditions warrant. The statement also predicts that exceptionally low Fed funds rates are likely to be warranted for a quote-unquote extended period of time. In this way, the statement provides explicit communication about the FOMC's future plans for short-term rates, and so shapes the level of current longer-term interest rates, because longer-term interest rates are a product of people's expectations of future short-term rates. Now, QE provides a significant supplement to this explicit verbal communication in the statement. The use of QE indicates that the FOMC is likely to keep its target rate lower for an even longer period of time. Indeed, one could readily argue that buying $600 billion of treasuries is a much more convincing form of communication of the FOMC's future plans than any words could ever be. So that's the first way QE lowers long-term real interest rates. It's by signaling what we're going to do in the future. But QE also lowers long-term real interest rates in a second, more direct way. The holder of a long-term treasury is exposed to interest rate risk. When interest rates go up, the value of that bond is going to go down. When interest rates go down, that value of that bond is going to go up. When the Fed buys $600 billion of long-term bonds, the bond portfolio of the private sector is now less exposed to this kind of interest rate risk. As a consequence, private investors will demand a lower premium for holding other bonds that are exposed to interest rate risk. That means all long-term yields will fall. So in this way, the change in the Fed's balance sheet provides stimulus to the economy. So I've been focusing on the asset side of the balance sheet and how it works to stimulate lower long-term rates, the changes in that lower long-term rates. What about the liability side of the Fed's balance sheet? So QE creates more reserves in banks' accounts with the Fed. And the standard reasoning is that this kind of reserve creation is inflationary. The reason people say that is banks are only allowed to offer checkable deposits in proportion to their reserves. Checkable deposits are a form of money because, like cash, they make many transactions easier. So in this sense, bank reserves held with the Fed are licenses. They're licenses for banks to create a certain amount of money. By giving out more licenses, the FOMC is allowing the banks to create more money. And then you have more money chasing the same amount of goods, voila, inflation. Given some of the criticisms of the Fed that have been voiced over the past 3 weeks, I think it is important to understand that this basic logic is not valid in current circumstances. Banks already have nearly $1 trillion of excess reserves. This means they're not using nearly $1 trillion of their existing licenses to create money. QE is going to give them another $600 billion of these licenses. But I do not see why they're going to start to use these new licenses when they weren't using the old ones. Now, some observers have expressed the concern that these excess reserves represent what they would term kindling for some future inflationary fire. I believe that these concerns are misplaced for two reasons. First, the Fed has several tools with which to combat incipient inflationary pressures. The most obvious one is it can raise the interest rate on excess reserves as a way of deterring banks from creating money with their licenses. Second, in recent public statements, Chairman Ben Bernanke has explicitly and firmly committed the FOMC to maintaining low inflation. To use his exact words, he said that he has, quote, rejected any notion that we were going to try to raise inflation to a supernormal level, unquote. Now, as I mentioned before, I didn't vote. I don't vote currently on FOMC decisions, but I did express support for the FOMC's decision at the recent meeting. As I have said on prior occasions, I believe there are good reasons to suspect that the ultimate effects of any amount of QE are likely to be relatively modest. Nonetheless, the FOMC's decision seemed to me to be a move in the right direction. So that's basically the conditions facing the FOMC in November and its decision, the decision making that it undertook. In the remainder of my prepared remarks, I'll dig a little deeper into the behavior of the labor market, and then I'll use that discussion to talk about some longer run uncertainties that I see as a drag on short run and medium term economic performance. So I'll begin by reminding you of some terms that economists use to talk about labor markets. Every month, the Census Bureau interviews 60,000 households, consisting of about 110,000 individuals. The Bureau asks them a host of questions, but I'm going to focus on two particularly important ones. First, have you worked for pay or profit in the past week? Second, if you have not worked for pay or profit in the past week, have you looked for work in the past 4 weeks? If you answered yes to the first question, you're counted as employed. If you answered yes to the second question, you're counted as unemployed. If you didn't answer no to both questions, you're not in the labor force. You're out of the labor force. So the sum of the two groups, employed and unemployed, is called the labor force. Note that the Census Bureau pays no attention to whether the interviewee is collecting unemployment benefits or not. That's just some orthogonal thing that they don't even ask about. So with those definitions, employed, unemployed, and labor force in mind, I'll divide the unemployed myself further into two subgroups. So first, following the Bureau of Labor Statistics, I'll refer to those people who've been unemployed for more than 6 months as being long-term unemployed. Now, by way of contrast, I'll use the word term short-term unemployed to refer to those who've been unemployed for less than 6 months. Now, I do this realizing this latter terminology is more than a little misleading, because anyone's been unemployed for 6 months has been unemployed for a long, not a short period of time. Now, in December 2007, at the start of the recession, 4.1% of the labor force were short-term unemployed. The recession generated a marked increase in this number. It officially ended in the second quarter of 2009, and in June of that year, 6.7% of the labor force were short-term unemployed. So we went from 4.1 to 6.7. Over the next 14 months, the recovery generated a noticeable increase in job openings, and the short-term unemployment rate responded by regaining nearly half of its recession losses. By the end of October 2010, 5.6% of the labor force was short-term unemployed. So we went from 4.1 up to 6.7, back down to 5.6. So if you're only looking at this limited measure of unemployment, you would say, well, the economy certainly has a long way to go, but we have made progress. In some sense, we're about halfway back, a little less than that. Now, I should note that this recovery in the short-term unemployment rate has slowed since May. The problem is that the long-term unemployment rate has not exhibited even this limited amount of progress. In December of 2007, only around 0.9% of the labor force was long-term unemployed for more than 6 months. In June of 2009, that number had more than tripled. It's 2.8% of the labor force had been unemployed for more than 6 months. By October 2010, 16 months into the recovery, that number had risen to 4%. That number is unprecedented in post-war history. As well, nearly three-fourths of the long-term unemployed, these people who have been unemployed for more than 6 months, had in fact been unemployed for over a year. Again, it is unprecedented in post-World War II U.S. history to have 3% of the labor force unemployed for over a year. And if history is any guide, this year-plus unemployment rate will only revert to pre-recession levels after several years. The recession has also had a big impact on the employment population ratio. In March of 2007, 63.4% of those over 16 had a job, and that number has fallen to 58.3%. Again, this is very low. Other than last December, the employment population ratio had not been this low since mid-1983, 27 years ago. Now, let me try to give you some context of what this means. I think about it a slightly different way. In March of 07, every working person supported 0.58 people over the age of 16, in addition to themselves. In October 2010, each working person in the United States supports 0.72 people in addition to themselves. Essentially, every working person now has to support 24% extra people beyond their own, beyond themselves. This is a large increase in the burden on every working person. And the question that faces this is this fall in the employment population ratio I just described going to reverse itself over the next 3 or 4 years? And the standard of living of many Americans will depend on whether it will or not. So I've been emphasizing uncertainties in the labor market. More generally, I believe that overall uncertainty is a large drag in the economic recovery. One way to think about that level of uncertainty is to look at the level of yields on TIPS bonds, their inflation-protected treasury securities. A 5-year TIPS bond now has a yield of minus 20 basis points. What does that mean? That means people are giving up $100 today in exchange for $99 of purchasing power in 5 years when they buy TIPS bonds. Savers are willing to lose purchasing power over time rather than consume more today. Similarly, firms are willing to lose purchasing power over time rather than making more capital expenditures. Why are firms and savers doing this? The answer is uncertainty. Some of this uncertainty is intrinsic to the structure of the U.S. economy itself. I've discussed the importance of the employment population ratio. Will the level of employment in 2015 look more like employment in 2000, 2007, or 2010? My own assessment of the level of house prices is another form of uncertainty. Will they look like, in 2015, look like what they did in 2000, 2007, or 2010? My own assessment is that no policymaker or set of policymakers, no matter how gifted, has the tools available to resolve these uncertainties. But part of the public's uncertainty has to do with the nature of future taxes and government spending. The federal debt in the hands of the public has gone up by over 50% in the last 3 years. At the same time, the U.S. has taken on responsibilities for the debts of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It has enacted a new health care plan. Do these changes mean that taxes will rise? If so, taxes on what form of economic activity? Does it mean that the government will cut back on its provision of important types of public goods? If so, what kinds of public goods? Will it cut back on various entitlement programs? If so, which ones? Investors and savers need a lot more clarity about what those answers might be. Absent such clarity, the economic recovery will be slower than it otherwise would be. Now, I have some bad news. I don't have the answers to these and other questions available for you at this time. But I do feel from my travels around the 9th District that the answers may lie within the upper Midwest. It is certainly true that many parts of the district have found the recent recession to be challenging. Nonetheless, the district has generally fared better economically during the recent recession than the nation as a whole. Some of this relative success can be explained by strong markets for oil, minerals, and agricultural commodities. But it is also true that many cities in the 9th District, including Sioux Falls, are mostly removed from those economic phenomena, and yet they continue to perform well. We at the Minneapolis Fed are continuing to work hard at understanding the factors that help us understand the relative success of the 9th District. And we very much hope that they prove to be ideas or approaches that can be replicated at the national level.